Welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM. We've got a few more to add to the group now. Hello to listeners on Halifax Community Radio, that's Calderdale FM, and also to listeners in Huddersfield, that's Kirklees FM. Quite a list.
We're going into reputed big cat country because local residents in recent weeks have seen a large black cat.
Yes, indeed. Coming up in the programme, our reporter Anthea Page has a feature on Winchcombe Walking Festival. Tony Gosling brings his feature on the Battle of the Beanfield, which took place on the afternoon of Saturday, the 1st of June, 1985, when Wiltshire police prevented a vehicle convoy of several hundred New Age travellers, known as the Convoy, and referred to in the media as the Peace Convoy, from setting up at the 11th Stonehenge Free Festival at Stonehenge.
Malcolm reads another instalment of Lady Stanhope's Travels. We've got poetry from Tim Burrows, and we've also got the What's On Guide with Jeff Sparks. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. It's been a pleasure to welcome Tess Green, who's a representative of the Green Party, no less. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about your own personal involvement in the Green Party. What is your role?
Well, at the moment, I'm a councillor in Bristol, and I've been a councillor for just over 2 years. There are two Green councillors in Bristol, and there's been a Green councillor for 8 years, or 9 years now, I think. So we have had some input into the political process.
Okay.
In Bristol City.
In terms of how the councillor system works in Bristol, how many sort of councillors do you have overall, do you know?
We have 70 councillors. At the moment, the Liberal Democrat Party is the largest party, but it isn't large enough to outvote all of the other parties, so it has what we call no overall control.
Yeah, okay.
So they do have to speak to the other parties and get agreement to take their policies forward.
What other minority parties do you share similar sort of space with?
We don't really. We're by far the smallest minority, with only two. The Conservative Party would be next, and I can't remember how many they've got, but in the low teens.
OK, not that many.
No.
Tell me a little bit about the mayoral election, because does that change how this council system will work and your place?
Yeah, nobody really knows exactly how it will change. It will depend who's elected and what kind of style they want to use to be the leader of the council. If it was a Green mayor, and we will put up a candidate, that person would tend to lead from behind, would tend to be very much progressing the democratisation of neighbourhoods so that ordinary people could make as many decisions for themselves as possible. But I doubt if other parties would have that kind of take on it.
So if there is an opportunity available to have a Green mayor, does that mean the Green Party was keen on the idea of there being a mayor for Bristol? Were you sort of urging people to vote for it?
No, not at all. We actually think it's a waste of money. It's putting too much power in one person's hands, and it attracts very often the very wrong kind of person to be the right leader. We actually think you need quite a humble person to be in a leadership role in Bristol, and the role of elected mayor may well attract people who are quite self-seeking, and I don't think that would be good for the city.
Okay, so that's interesting. I guess the difference between that working or not would be if the candidates who were put up for election in the first place were voted upon in a democratic way, or whether the party's just put forward the most hungry candidates. Is that what you think will happen?
I don't know. I mean, in our party, and I think the other parties will be similar, they will invite nominations and there will be a number of people who are interested in doing it, and then the party will select from amongst those people. And in our case, we will do that by hearing from those people, being able to question them and ask them how they intend to carry out the role. And then the membership of the Green Party will decide who is the most suitable.
In which ward are you a councillor?
I'm a councillor in Southville, which is just south of the river, quite near the city centre.
OK. What was your take when you first became a councillor for that area in terms of what green issues were going on specifically in that area?
Well, I was particularly interested in planning. Southville is a very densely populated, mainly Victorian housing, and there isn't much space left for development. And the space which we did have was being filled with rather horrible flats, too small, mainly one bedroom, not very well built, not very well designed, didn't really fit in with what's already there. And a lot of the local people didn't like that. And I thought I could have some influence on that as a councillor, being on a what we call a development control committee.
Okay.
The reality isn't quite like that, of course. As the only green, there's very little influence. And, you know, I found myself having to be the only one voting against some things, although not always. Some of the other parties, councillors would see things from the same.
You'd have thought somebody like the Lib Dems, for example, might be quite keen on getting a bit of the green vote in as well.
Yes,
as
they
a progressive
are.
Sort of fair party, they're all about things being fair.
Yeah, I mean, things are obviously in shades, and there are some Lib Dem councillors who are good green thinking people. Then they don't come from the same perspective as people who are members of the Green Party, but they do think it's important to take the environment into consideration. So, they might well think about particular issues in a similar way to us.
So in what areas do you think you are most disappointed with councillors who are from the three main parties in terms of green issues?
Well, all of them are fixated on economic growth. And economic
growth... Not unreasonable.
Well, it is unreasonable because we live on a finite planet. We're using the resources of that planet as if they are not finite, as if we've got loads of oil, loads of all the minerals that we use every day, and most important of all, that the planet can absorb all the carbon gases that we're emitting from all this activity.
So it can't,
and the climate is changing, and it is not going to be good for the human race. And none of the other parties seem to grasp this.
So do you see that economic growth is totally at odds with the idea of being green? I mean, economic growth can occur in ways that are not necessarily damaging to the planet.
That is true, but we have to be very careful. There is this notion of sustainable growth. Now, true sustainability means that you don't actually use the resources beyond the planet's capacity and beyond what your share is as this present generation. What we're doing now is using the resources that should be there for the people of the future, and they won't have them.
Aren't people who are going to be living on, you know, on a very small amount of money, particularly a lot of people out of work, and economic issues are really hitting home, particularly families, they're really going to be struggling. Aren't these issues going to pale in significance? Aren't you going to have a tough job to try and sell, you know, maybe let's forget about economic growth?
Well, no, because we could have growth which would benefit everybody. For instance, most people want to live in a warm, comfortable home, and that would benefit the environment if we didn't have to use so much fuel to heat homes. In fact, it's perfectly possible to produce a home which doesn't need any external energy to heat it. But we're not concentrating on that. That would produce jobs in the insulation industry, in the construction industry. It would produce jobs.
Okay, so the Green Party has ideas for economic growth, but
definitely
your ideas don't seem to fit with where other people are focusing. They're focusing on easy money.
Yeah, precisely.
Well.
And they're not looking at the future and what's going to happen when we start running out of resources.
How do you think the Green Party is doing nationally? I mean, obviously, there's only two councillors here in Bristol, but I mean, on terms of a national scale, how do you think you're doing?
Well, we've got our first MP, who's Caroline Lucas, and most people who come across Caroline Lucas are really full of praise for her.
Brighton and Hove, is that right?
Brighton and Hove, that's right, and that's the Greens are in control of that council. There are quite a lot of councils which have a number of Green councillors. Sometimes they have control of a council, but even where they don't, if there are enough Green councillors, they can exert quite a lot of influence.
Okay, so with, you know, if people get more Green and they vote, you know, things can change in favour of the Green Party.
I think they are. I mean, the change that I've seen in the last couple of years is the number of young people who are joining the party.
Okay, I'll stop you there because we're kind of running a little, going to run out of time, but if you grow as a party, you're going to have to be able to say what your position is on an increasingly huge array of stuff, not a lot of which may necessarily be green particularly. And we were speaking before the interview started briefly about the police commissioners. They're planning on having elections for police commissioners. I understand the Green Party has a position on that.
Yeah, we don't think it's a good idea to mix politics with policing, and that's exactly what it will do, because the people that would be put up to be elected as police commissioners will, on the whole, be from political parties, and one of those will be elected from a party and will carry the baggage of that particular political party with them.
So how could people, if they wish to explore, you know, what your position is, particularly on economic matters, you know, in areas which are not necessarily particularly green, where could people go and find out what the Green Party's...
We've got a very good website, and I would recommend that people look at the Green Party website, because, and they will find, they will be surprised at the policies we have. We have policies on health, on education, on construction, on you name it, we've got policies, very well thought out policies, that, and those policies are formed at our 6 monthly conferences by the members of the party.
Okay, well, Tessa Green, thank you very much for coming in, and I hope that we'll be able to get you back in sometime in the future and catch up on how the Green Party is doing.
Okay, thank you.
It was 18 years ago this weekend that hundreds of travellers in their coaches, lorries and other vehicles were forced by the police off the road and told to park up in a West Country field. It was the decade of Thatcherism, the 80s, and the Tory Prime Minister had vowed to break the unions and the travellers. What happened next goes down in history alongside the miners' strike the year before and the Wapping printer strike the year after. The so-called Battle of the Beanfield took place on the 1st of June 1985, just off the A303 in Wiltshire. But it was the culmination of years of Britain's counterculture, as author of the definitive book on the battle to break the back of England's traveller movement, Andy Worthington, explains to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
I'm Andy Worthington. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, filmmaker. One of the ways that I started getting into writing in general was by writing a couple of books, one of which was an overview of British countercultural history, essentially since the Second World War. And a large part of that involved the traveller movement, the Free Festival movement of the 1970s. And as an offshoot from that, I devoted an entire book to the kind of pivotal moment in that movement, which was the violent suppression of the Free Festival movement and the Travellers by Margaret Thatcher, which took place at what's become known as the Battle of the Beanfield, which was in a field alongside the A303, not far from Stonehenge, on June the 1st, 1985. And it was as a group of several hundred travellers in convoy were attempting to reach the field opposite Stonehenge to establish what would have been the 12th Stonehenge Free Festival.
So can you tell us, put the whole thing in context a bit, and tell us what was this sort of counterculture that had developed after the Second World War of travelling people?
The context of the counterculture was essentially in people questioning the status quo. I suppose one of the key elements was questioning the notion of who owned property, who owned the land. In a post-war context, then, I suppose the first example of that would be the returnees from the Second World War and the large squatting movement that took place at that time. People came back after the Second World War to find that there wasn't really much of a place for them. So, you know, it was a pretty instant response to that. I mean, some of the occupations were of, you know, airfields and buildings that were available in that way, barracks. You know, I mean, that's an interesting period because, of course, you know, it also led to essentially, you know, so much of what we understand as the welfare state that came out of that period, a huge building project, exactly the kind of opposite responses to a desperate financial situation than what we're getting today, which is a government devoted only to savagely cutting everything that involves the state. But yeah, I mean, I suppose a lot of people don't really realise that you know, squatting doesn't involve the traditional idea of these people without jobs invading buildings that belong to other people. And actually, I'm sure that it tells a very good thing about squatting, which is that it's driven by need. It's not actually an affectation. It's that people are in need of housing, which is what prompts it. That's the immediate post-World War II origins. And then as we get into the 60s and the kind of more understandable modern notion of the counterculture, we have people beginning to question who owns property, who owns land, and various movements starting along those lines. So a big squatting movement in Britain, a very big squatting movement in London. You then had people importing some of the ideas from the States of the diggers, which was actually an idea that had been picked up from English history, but it developed in the Free Festival movement, the hippie movement in the States, that was then kind of re-imported back into England of people wanting to take back the land. And that was a big driver for the whole Free Festival movement into the 1970s, and then this manifestation of the Travellers movement, where people, their response to the difficulties of the 1970s, the lack of work, and the kind of desperate, dead-end nature of a lot of places where there was no work and nothing to do, was people getting vehicles and going on the road. And I think for a lot of people involved in that, it was an adventure, it was a way out of this dead end they were in.
I think for a lot of people, probably, it was also a motivating force behind it. It was not actually young people not wanting to sort of follow in the footsteps of their parents, not wanting necessarily to be tied to a job or an address, for seeing that as a sort of being an impediment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Although I think, you know, the driver for it was, you know, was massive unemployment, was the need to find something to do. You know, and what's interesting, particularly are the elements of that that were very, very political. I mean, fundamentally, I think that it's regarded as deeply subversive by the establishment to have people wandering around with no fixed address, travelling in vehicles. Some of the people that are involved in that explicitly knew that what they were doing was challenging the assumptions about land, about where you could park, about where you could live, about how land was used. But, you know, there were a lot of elements in it, and one of them was the kind of nascent green movement in the UK in a lot of ways. Some of the protests that people got involved in were against nuclear power or were against cruise missiles, which is interesting that what we had at Greenham was the women's camps. Women were strip-searched at various times at Greenham. There were sonic bombardments that were used on them. But what the state couldn't really do to an encampment solely of women was to wade in there and beat them all up with truncheons. It just would have been a PR disaster. So when the Travellers movement became involved in Molesworth in the summer of 1984, it was in Cambridgeshire and was meant to be the second cruise missile base after Greenham Common. So there was a camp there from the summer of 84 until the kind of winter, the early months of 1985, when there was an absolutely huge mobilization of military forces, the biggest peacetime mobilization of military forces in British history, to remove this encampment, led by Michael Heseltine at the time, who was flown in on a helicopter. And they were then shunted off and moved around for months, and the plans were put together to finally bring this movement to an end with what became known as the Battle of the Beanfield.
The idea of cruise missiles now, a lot of people don't know what they were. What was the objection to this? Was it simply that this was a upping of the arms race and made Britain a target unnecessarily?
Yeah, I think it was partly that. I mean, I think partly what people were... There was very much an anti-militaristic side to things. What also it involved was that these were American bases. Parts of Britain were being handed over to the Americans to use as launching pads for weapons of mass destruction. And understandably, I think people took exception to that. That really was the context for the decision to decommission the travelling convoy in 1985, and that Stonehenge could be the excuse. So on a PR level, they knew that a bunch of renegades travelling to set up this anarchic festival at Stonehenge for the 12th year running was going to be reasonably easy to sell to the public. And also because it wasn't just women, these were families, they didn't care about the fact that they would wade in there and decommission these people with extreme violence, which is, you know, what happened on the day. There were hundreds of vehicles involved, and the police essentially blocked a road. The vehicles ended up in this field, known as the Beanfield. There were over 1,000 police involved that day, drawn from 6 different police forces, and there were Ministry of Defence police as well. And there was a kind of standoff for many hours as the people were trapped in the field until essentially the order was given for the police to invade the field and to take these people out. And it's just pretty disgraceful, really, the violence that took place on that day. And most of the reporting of what happened has kind of disappeared. There was an ITV reporter, Kim Sabido, who reported live from the field and was visibly shocked at what was happening. There was also Nick Davis, who worked for The Observer, reported from there. He had a photographer whose photographs later mysteriously disappeared.
This is the same Nick Davis that's been actually at The Guardian responsible for digging out some of the dirt on Murdoch and the phone hacking.
It absolutely is, yeah. Yeah, he's got a very interesting career. There wasn't that much reporting on it. There were these disturbing aspects of how parts of the story disappeared. Kim Sabido, I think, that pretty much ended his career, his complaint live about the way these people were being treated. And unfortunately, it did have the effect that Margaret Thatcher wanted. This came the year after the miners' strike. It came the year before the assault on the print unions. It's really part of the trinity, I think, of Margaret Thatcher's attack: the miners, the travellers, and the printers.
Andy Worthington there, author of the fully illustrated book The Battle of the Beanfield, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. More from Andy next week as we hear about the fallout from the Thatcher government's attack on the travellers and the rise again, this time without their vehicles, of the anti-roads movement in the 1990s.
Our next feature takes us to the pretty town of Winchcombe, which nestles in the Cotswolds at the foot of Cleve Hill. Anthea Page joined a group of walkers for the annual walking festival. It's organised by the town, and she chatted to two of the organisers from the community, as well as some of the walkers, about the festival.
I'm here in Winchcombe and I've come to do a walking festival, and I'm here with a couple of the organisers. Hello.
Hello, I'm Robert and this is Pete. We're part of the main organising committee for the Winchcombe Walking Festival. Today is Saturday and we're here in lovely Winchcombe, a historic town set in a valley in the Cotswolds. It's renowned for walking. As I say, today is our second day and we're going to be taking people to Broadway, up on the hills, up over Langley Hill, Cleve Hill, which is the highest point in the Cotswolds. We're raring to go this morning.
Can you tell us a bit about how long the festival's been going?
Yes, this is the third year, started in 2010. Third year, three-day festival. So far, it's been very successful, keeping our fingers crossed for some good weather. Not quite so good as previously, but it doesn't seem to put the walkers off.
Certainly raised the profile of Winchcombe. Winchcombe has a lot of history, but it's not one of these honeypot towns. You know, when people talk about the Cotswolds, they always think of Broadway, Boughton-on-the-Water, Stow-on-the-Wold. Winchcombe is a working town. You know, you can live here and you can get most of your supplies. So what it has done is put Winchcombe on the map. For example, the latest rough guides to the Cotswolds and Bratt's Slow Cotswolds, which is an alternative guidebook, both promote Winchcombe as a walking centre. We've seen far more visitors to the town. If you go through the town any day of the week, you see walkers coming through because the Cotswold Way comes through here, the Gloucestershire Way comes through here, we have the Warden's Way, the Windrush Way, the Winchcombe Way. So we have quite a lot of different walks, and we also have St Ken Elms Trail, so there are walks for everybody.
Have you seen an increase in walkers over the years?
I think so. Winchcombe's a wonderful place to start and finish a walk from. Certainly you talk to the traders and there's no doubt that they are seeing more people coming through. Sometimes difficult to quantify exactly how much of this is as a result of what the festival does, but undoubtedly it spreads the word. People do come in.
We're part of a community-led national organisation, which is called Walkers Are Welcome. When we joined, we were the 28th town in the country and the first in the Cotswolds to get Walkers Are Welcome status. Since then, I think it's somewhere in the region of approaching 80 towns now with Walkers Are Welcome status. So we all work together, we give each other ideas and encouragement. And one of the walks today is going to a neighbouring village, Longborough, which is also a Walkers Are Welcome town. We all work together, we have an annual conference, and interestingly, there is also at this moment in time a big push along the English-Welsh borders. There's a project called Walking with Offa, and Chepstow, Monmouth and all those similar towns along the borders are all getting Walkers Are Welcome status this year.
If anyone is listening to this and wants to find out about walking, would they go on a website?
Yes, we've got our own website. So has Walkers Are Welcome. It's got a national website. But you can start with Winchcombe Walkers Are Welcome and take it from there, because you'll find plenty of information and give you plenty of ideas as to what to do.
I think you list local accommodation.
We try to be a one-stop shop. So we have not only downloadable walks, but we have accommodation lists, we have different types of shops. We catalogue every shop in Winchcombe. Winchcombe at the moment is bucking the recession. Every shop in Winchcombe is full. When we started this initiative in 2009, we had 7 or 8 shops empty in Winchcombe. It's starting to look a bit of a sorry state. It was my wife who then went to the council and suggested that Winchcombe looks to going to get Walkers Are Welcome status. And from there on, the shops are all fully occupied, more walkers in the town, are seeing an increase in turnover. And the spin-off of this is that now we're seen as a major force when it comes to tourism, and we're now being asked to talk at various conferences about rural sustainability. We're also being invited to meet people like the Minister of Tourism when he comes down, and we put forward our views because we fit in with the big society. We're virtually on the top of Langley Hill. We're just saying that normally you'd look across here and you would see Breedon Hill and Dumbleton Hill, which are the outlying hills of the Cotswolds. Then you're into the Severn Vale, looking across to the Malverns.
So spectacular views on a good day, but we've got mist.
We've got mist at the moment, yes. But, you know, you can hear the birds singing. We've got cowslips out just behind us there. Forget-me-nots, or we may see some deer or rabbits soon. We're now on the approaches of Langley Hill. We're going into reputed big cat country.
Why is that?
Well, because local residents in recent weeks have seen a large black cat, femoral link type cat.
Venture walk.
Yes, yes. And if we come across it, then everybody will have to just basically run and defend themselves.
I met someone from Sydney. How long have you lived in England?
Well, 5 years initially, then I've been in Switzerland and France for 20 years, but just come back last year and settled back in Ledbury in Herefordshire.
Why have you settled in Britain?
My wife's English and our children are at university here. My wife being English, I'm the odd one out.
So what do you miss about Australia?
Well, sunshine, really, I guess.
Are you two keen walkers?
Yes, pretty keen. We're members of Ramblers. We had an opportunity, we had a leave pass from our children today to come out for the day, so we're doing 2 walks.
Hell yeah.
Why are you walking today?
It's a hobby, really, to keep fit. I walk with several groups. I was introduced to this by the Meet and Eat group. This is why I'm here. I was here last year.
I'm now here with someone from Radio Winchcombe.
Hello. Greetings from the mist. Well, Radio Winchcombe launched yesterday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. Full-time radio station here in Winchcombe. We've got a range of about 5 miles or so, but we've been doing restrictive service license broadcasts for the last 7 years. That's 2 broadcasts for about 2 weeks each time, twice a year, but full-time, and we're doing proper presented programmes on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays. And we're doing continuous music and reruns of our presented programmes during the week. So it should be a real community service, and it's a community radio station, and we're looking for the whole community to become engaged with it.
This is an old tree stump that's been carved into a shepherd with his dog. This area here used to be Drover's Road. Well, it was carved for the millennium. So it's 12 years old now. He's got a few bits of woodwork. He's got a little dog as well down by his feet.
So we've now reached the highest point of the Cotswolds.
Now on Cleeve Common, as you said, it's the highest point. It's a site of special scientific interest.
We've just come through a gate, a wonderful view. Can you describe it?
This is the sort of the back of Cleeve Common, where basically you're only going to get walkers come through here. It reminds me a little bit of Yorkshire, really. we can see some remains of quarrying on our right, with little hummocks, and then there's a little valley going up there, and up that valley is a stream, and I would say about a quarter of a mile up there is the source of the River Isborne, which runs all the way through Winchcombe, and it's the only river that runs north for its entire length. But it is a lovely view, and we've got beech trees out here in the foreground. Behind there is Postlip Hall, beautiful old residence which was converted into apartments about 20 years ago. It goes back to about 1600s.
We're now walking along. What did you call this?
This is the old Cheltenham Road. Probably 100 years ago, this is what it was like to go from one town to another. It's got a hard standing. You can imagine if there was carts and that going along here, it would become quite rutted and muddy. Probably a dangerous place to journey as well, because you've got all these trees.
Highwaymen?
Well, it wasn't unknown. It wasn't unknown for robbers to be in collusion with inns, and if someone was travelling and they had some wealthy luggage, pass that information on. It's a very nice path. As I say, it's tree-lined, and it leads down to the new road, which skirts around the side of Cleve Hill now.
So we're standing in front of what was formerly an old mill.
Yes, this dates back to the 1700s, and we're looking at a couple of old outbuildings which probably were part of the original mill. But now, in 2012, they've got a brand new big building which houses the process, which turns paper which comes from America or Japan into high-grade filter paper for medical instruments. There's about 40 people work here. A lot of them are from Winchcombe. Some of them are second generation, I know. So yes, it's very much welcome, and as it's on the outskirts of Winchcombe, people can walk, cycle to work. Everybody always has to get into a car around here. We're very rural. We have an antiquated bus service, and otherwise you have to use your car.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page and to the interviewees there, and let's look forward to the annual walking festival, seeing as there's no Glastonbury this year.
Next up, Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter from the travels of Lady Hester Stanhope from the book by Virginia Childs.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, by Virginia Childs. Michael had not been having a very enjoyable time in Aleppo. He had missed having a male companion when Lord Sligo left, and the only good thing that had happened whilst he was away was that he had become good friends with Mr. Barker, the British Consul General in the Levant. When he and Mr. Barker heard that Hester was poised to leave for Palmyra, they decided that she couldn't possibly make the journey on her own, and set out for Damascus immediately. They were both horrified to discover that she had been planning to go with only a small escort, and Michael sent a barrage of messages saying she must wait for them and that they must all travel with a large caravan, which would be much safer. Hester replied promptly and firmly, telling him that even if there were a caravan going in the right direction, she had absolutely no intention of joining one. This alarmed Michael so much that he replied with instructions that she must travel in a contraption called a tartaravan, which he and Mr. Barker would bring along with them from Aleppo. A tartaravan was a kind of sedan chair drawn by mules, and nothing could have been calculated to appeal to Hester less. She was a superlative rider, and knowing her as he did, it is quite staggering that Michael should even have given the idea a second thought. Perhaps Mr. Barker's influence was at work. Hester's reaction was predictable. "What an absurd idea," she scoffed. She could see exactly what would happen in the event of attack. To be stuck upon a machine, the Tartar of Angie's running away and leaving you at the mercy of two obstinate mules. She was completely vindicated in refusing both propositions when, only a few days later, a large caravan passing between Homs and Damascus was attacked, even though it had 50 armed guards. 16 people were killed. "Who is right?" she demanded. "I or the Consul General?" She knew where she would rather be in an emergency, and it was astride the swiftest horse one can find. Hester was furious at this high-handed interference in her plans. "It seems very cross to be angry at people being anxious about you," she wrote in November. "But had Mr. Bruce and Mr. Barker made less fuss about my safety, and let me had perfectly my own way, I should have been returned by this time from Palmyra." All these delays meant that it was now too close to the unpredictable winter months for safety, so the expedition was postponed. Just as he was wondering what her next step should be, Lady Hester received a visit from a young Bedouin called Nassar, who was Mahanar's eldest son. He had come to invite Lady Hester to stay for a few days in the desert with his father and his tribes. He was eloquent, polite, and charming. "Instead of the ferocious animals she had been taught to expect," Marian later wrote, "her ladyship saw in the Bedouins a well-bred people, apparently dignified in their sentiments, and who, in bidding her repose confidence in them, knew how to inspire it." Nassar indicated that he and his father would also like to provide Lady Hester's escort to Palmyra. "To a personage like you," he said, "the road is open wherever you choose to go. We know what is due to an illustrious princess." He admitted that they often robbed travellers in the desert, but only those who come armed against us. Others they treated differently. "Towards those who claim the rights of hospitality from us, we know how to exercise them." Hester was very impressed by the young man and decided that she would accept his father's invitation. If her stay with Mahanar was a success, then she would also accept his offer to escort her. Now that she was no longer relying on the Pasha for help in crossing the desert, Hester decided it would be better to spend the winter at a town called Hamar, situated on the river Orontes, halfway between Damascus and Aleppo, and on the fringes of the Palmyran desert itself. It was much closer to Palmyra, and the Bedou occasionally came into the town to buy cloth and other essentials, so it would also be a good base from which to meet Mahanar. Michael and Mr. Barker had left Aleppo by this time. Hester still felt extremely disgruntled with them and was not inclined to be sympathetic when Mr. Barker fell ill on the way back to Damascus. Sending Dr. Marion to help Michael nurse the Consul General back to health, she made what she called an experiment on the good faith of the Arabs. She went to Hamar and then into the desert, alone save for an interpreter and a few servants, and met the Arab chief Mahanar El Fadel, whose reputation was one of power and unyielding ferocity. Mahanar was a man of about 55, with a large, shaggy beard and bushy eyebrows. He was rather deaf, and made up for his lack of hearing with piercing eyes that missed nothing. With the exception of a fine vest of red and yellow striped damask satin, he was roughly dressed, like any of his men. The only tangible sign of his rank was that his tent was bigger than any of the others. As a delicate compliment to her host, Lady Hester dressed as the son of a Bedou chief and looked superb. She wore a Bedouin handkerchief upon her head, bound on with a sort of rope made of camel's hair, a curly sheepskin pelisse, a white abar, a little gold on the right shoulder, crimson and loop button, and two crimson strings to fasten it. Mahanar was charmed. Marian reported that when this fearsome chief saw a fair and elegant woman who had ventured upon those wastes where many a man has trembled to go, and where he knew she had been taught to expect nothing but brutality, he looked upon her with admiration. More than that, he developed a respect and almost paternal affection for her, which guaranteed their subsequent safety in the desert, and always afterwards referred to her as one of his family. Lady Hester was utterly entranced with Mahanar and his Bedou. She stayed with them for a week and marched for 3 days with his encampment. She was treated with the greatest respect and hospitality, and the visit was completely unlike any experience she had ever had before. "Horses and mares fed upon camel's milk," she wrote afterwards. Arabs living upon little else except a little rice and sometimes a sort of bread. The space around me covered with living things, 12,000 camels coming to water from one tribe only. The old poets from the banks of the Euphrates singing the praises and the feats of ancient heroes. Children quite naked, women with lips dyed light blue and their nails red, and hands all over flowers and designs of different kinds. Lady Hester felt an immediate and powerful affinity for the desert people, which was entirely reciprocated. She felt that their pride, self-respect and independence in the face of utter poverty was the antithesis of the rich and corrupt Europeans who so lazily condemned her way of life and who dismissed these same Arabs as savages. Her friend Mahanar was obeyed like a great king, although his appearance was as rough and unkempt as those of his people. Hester herself was treated as a queen, which suited her perfectly. She was electrified by the feeling of power invoked in her by their unanticipated deference, rather as one might feel if a dangerous wild animal came to lie at one's feet. An emotional surge of something akin to love and gratitude reinforced the feelings of respect and admiration she felt for these untamed Bedouin people. She examined her feelings and used an example in an attempt to understand her unexpected exhilaration. To look around one, free is the air of the desert. To observe something like a flight of crows at a distance. To look proudly that way, move your hand and in one instant see 50 lances spring in your defence. To see them return, exclaiming, "Shkab, friends!" Multiply the number to 40,000, the size of Mahanar's tribe, and it was intoxicating stuff indeed. And so began the last great love of her life. It started with the Bedou people, and although it was not confined to them, they were the embodiment of all that she sought to embrace for the rest of her days. What she fell in love with was a strange mixture. It was honour and chivalry. It was freedom tempered with integrity. But since she was as used to life with leaders in Downing Street as she now was with pashas in Syria, these high ideals were inevitably mixed with something perhaps more human. The spice of intrigue and power.
Thank you very much to Mark and Grieve there, reading us another chapter of Lady Hester Stanhope, and more next week.
It's a pleasure to welcome Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
So what have you got for us today? What is your musical muse that you're exercising?
Oh, this is my song I wrote a bit back, but I've kind of updated it about my experiences working at Gordano Services when I used to live at
home. Ah, working at motorway services.
Yeah, and all the cobalt loading and bin clearing and mopping floors and pouring out teas and stuff, and it was long hours and it's in the song.
Okay.
I'm sitting down the cab stand, waiting for the bus to take me to Gordano. Hydrated
in saccharine. My prices and mad wages now, you motorway service stream. I've got my forage care, my dirty brown uniform. I hide the temps in the toilets there when the food inspector comes. Just grease hydrate and saccharine, prices and bad wages, your motorway service stream. And I'll be feeding all of them truckers for mopping up them dirty floors and trying not to freeze. 'Cause it's grease and dirty wrappers of a hydrate and saccharine, the prices and your motorway service dream. Spending all my days sitting on the bus. Take me to Gordano services and all that mush and stuff. This grease and dirty wrapper, hydrate and saccharine, prices and bad wages now, your motorway service dream. And yes, there, Mr. Forty, you got a but all your low-paid workers there stretch home without a smile. It's grease and dirty wrappers, carbohydrate and saccharine, prices and bad wages now, your motorway service street.
Well, thank you very much for that, Tim. I'm curious to know if the people working at Gordano Services, you know, can they have a copy of this song? Have you sent it to them?
I haven't actually sent it to them. I might busk it outside.
You should do so, yeah. So get something to video you being turned out by security.
Years back, so there's probably not anyone working there that I work with. But
okay. Anyway. Well, up some worker solidarity by sending it around to all the poor people. Thank you very much, Tim Burris.
Okay, cheers.
It's my pleasure to welcome back to the studio our regular Jeff Sparks with his What's On Guide. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Wednesday, 6th of June, Urban Voodoo Machine will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 7pm. It is worth noting that Urban Voodoo Machine are booked to perform at this year's Bulldog Bash. Into Thursday, 7th of June, NoFX will be performing with support from Margate and also Anti-Nowhere League at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18.50 in advance and doors open at 6pm. Worth noting that NoFX are currently on tour, so check out their website for further dates. Into Song of the Week, and I present Slash, featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators. For those who don't know, Slash was in Guns N' Roses, Slash's Snake Pit, Velvet Revolver, and now he's doing solo work. His first album was released in 2010. This album, Apocalyptic Love, was released in 2012, and here is a track from the album titled Halo. That was Slash with Halo from his new solo album Apocalyptic Love. For more information, you can check out www.slashonline.com. into Friday, 8th of June, Shilana Gig will be performing with support from the Destroyers and Bartone at the Fiddlers in Wilway Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, into Saturday, 9th of June, it's a local punk night featuring Gentlemen Punk Rockers, TLI, with support from Filthy Rich and the Cat Flaps at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Nice one. Thanks, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guest was Tess Green from the Green Party, and features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling.
Malcolm Grieve read an excerpt from Lady Hester's Travels from the book by Virginia Childs, and we had poetry by Tim Burrows and Rosemary Dunn. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks, who's back in the studio with the What's On Guide.
The studio engineer was Mike Noyce, and the producer was Alec Milne. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
So it's goodbye from us until next week.
Indeed, goodbye.
Stuff was started, things had ended.